This episode contains explicit discussion of sexual abuse and sexual harassment.
Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Varsha.
And I'm Devin. And today we are doing something a little bit different. We are completely restructuring our show for today. I was just talking to Varsha about it. We have been talking about Brett Kavanaugh every week for what feels like forever. And that's been really important. And there's a lot going on with that story, and there's a lot of disgusting thing that's going on with that story. And as we come up on the one-year anniversary of, quote-unquote, anniversary of the Me Too movement, when Harvey Weinstein was openly accused of sexual harassment and assault, we are going to kind of dig a little bit into not the hashtag Me Too movement itself, because that is sort of its own force and its own thing. But what I want to talk about is how the Me Too movement hasn't brought new issues to the surface. It's simply telling the stories that have already happened and the sort of importance of where we are now and how we have gotten there through the misdeeds of powerful men and not powerful men. Everyone we're about to talk about are well-known in their field. We're going to be talking about judges and CEOs and heads of media companies and, you know, senators. But there are so many men that never get this sort of spotlight shined on them. And this is why I've spoken and worked closely with a lot of women from the National Domestic Workers Alliance and other groups where their focus is on women who get harassed by powerful men who don't have high profiles, whose harassment is largely unnoticed. And the fear is real and often without recourse. So I just want to remind everyone that that is a part of this story as well. But we're going to spend the whole hour talking about this topic and kind of figuring out where we are.
Yeah. And you mentioned that, like, not all the men get a spotlight. And so, like, before we start, I just wanted to point out that last week, a McDonald's worker and a single mother named Adriana Alvarez led a group of protesters, a Me Too protest in a McDonald's against sexual harassment in their workplace, right? And it was one McDonald's franchise. And workers across the food service industry have been speaking up about harassment for years. But this one protest has gotten a lot of like press. And that's because, not because of the Me Too movement, but because of how differently we're talking about sexual harassment. And I just wanted to highlight, like, there are cases of people, you know, talking about the daily effect of sexual harassment in their daily lives, which is really important. Okay, Devin, where does this story begin in the judiciary? Or where do one of these stories begin in the judiciary?
So we're gonna back up a little bit. Our story begins in 1975. And I know that's a long time ago, and I promise I'm making a point. But this starts with a judge named Alex Kaczynski. And in 1975, he started clerking for a Ninth Circuit Court judge named Anthony Kennedy. And he clerked there for a year. And then he moved up through the ranks. He worked in the Reagan White House. He was appointed head of the Court of Appeals. Reagan then nominated Kaczynski to the Ninth Circuit Court, which is in California. And that was in 1985. So Kaczynski is a judge on the Ninth Circuit. And in 1991, Kavanaugh ends up clerking for this judge, Alex Kaczynski. And he's there for a year. And this is where I want to sort of pause the story and do a quick cut scene. Kavanaugh clerks for Kaczynski in 1991. And then in 1993, on the recommendation from Kaczynski, Kavanaugh also clerks for Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. When Kaczynski clerked for him, he wasn't Supreme Court, but Kavanaugh clerked for him while he was on the Supreme Court. And then Kavanaugh goes on to become a partner at a fancy law firm and works with Ken Starr, is in the Bush White House. We kind of have the outline of his story from his confirmation hearings. So, and what's also important is that I'm going to throw another name in there. In 2006 to 2007, a woman named Heidi Bond begins clerking for Alex Kaczynski. And she becomes important because this is where Kaczynski's thread starts to intertwine with what's going on right now. Because Kaczynski had left the bench in disgrace after allegations of sexual assault and sexual abuse from his former law clerks, including Heidi Bond. And there were a lot of allegations, and a lot of Maisie Hirono called it was an open secret that Alex Kaczynski was a disgusting sexual harasser and abuser. And he had a listserv called the Easy Rider Gag List, where he would disseminate obscene material to people on this list. He often had women come into his office and watch pornography, and he would make comments about their breasts. And if you can think of the textbook definition of harassment in the workplace, sexual harassment in the workplace, I mean, Alex Kaczynski could have written the fucking book. So what I want to do here is to take a second to draw the line from Anthony Kennedy to Kaczynski to Kavanaugh. And that I'm not saying that Anthony Kennedy has sexually abused or harassed anyone. No one has come forward. We don't know that. But what I really want to set up in this story before we go any further into the sexual harassment portion of it is that these are three extremely powerful men, one of whom is already on the Supreme Court, another one who is nominated for the Supreme Court. And this story starts in 1975. So from 1975 to 2018, there is a direct line between three powerful white men who have ruined the careers and lives of so many women, it's probably incalculable. And the reason we're here in this sticky wicket we're in today is because of this type of straight line. It's because this kind of power has been centralized to white men and has been so exclusionary to everyone else that we are in a system where someone like Brett Kavanaugh could even potentially be nominated for a Supreme Court position. I just want to set that up as sort of a bounding box, a framework of what we're about to talk about. Varsha, can you tell us a little bit more about the sexual harassment portion of this?
Yeah. So as we know, like Kaczynski was accused by over, I think, almost like six women. Six women accused him of like acting inappropriately, sexual misconduct, sexual harassment. And one of the main stories was, as you mentioned, Heidi Bond. She recalled the judge describing him as his slave. And there was like an email list, not just like that Easy Rider list, but like that email list wasn't just for him. That was for other women and men within who were clerking for him, right? And so when Judge Kavanaugh was before the court, or was before the Senate recently in his hearings, he said he had no knowledge of this list. And I find that to be complete bullshit, right? That's another thing that I think he's lied about. Kaczynski wouldn't just like share this list among his peers, but also his clerks. And what's really like frustrating about this is, as you mentioned, like Maisie Hirono said, it was like an open secret. So did like Dahlia Litwick, who people probably read her work. She was a former Ninth Circuit clerk as well. And she literally said everybody knew, but nobody said anything, right? And so I want to connect this to the fact that this is also true of the Weinstein stories. This is true of other stories we've heard of like powerful men, where as soon as the accusations come out, people start saying, who are in the know, quote unquote, that, oh yeah, this was an open secret. This was, everyone knew about this, but nobody did anything. Because the people in power are these men who can retaliate if you attempt to do anything. And it takes a lot of pressure and a lot of force. And it's sometimes like reporting like this that actually gets anything done, right? And so finally, you know, Kaczynski retires or resigns in disgrace in 2017. He resigns because of more than a dozen allegations of sexual harassment and a pending investigation. So finally, like the court, the judiciary are like investigating him because it's egregious, right? But this is just one case. And you have no idea of the thousands of judges in this country. You have no idea how many other cases like this exist, right? Because I also want to make the case that the system of clerkship that we have can be really beneficial, right? I know people who are, you know, who are currently clerking and people who have clerked, and it's, it's an amazing experience for them, but it's also a really weird power dynamic where your whole career depends on doing well for that judge, doing well for that justice, right? And your whole career depends on making sure you don't rock the boat. And so it makes sense why Dahlia Lithwick and all these people can say, oh, it was an open secret, right? And then the next story we want to connect this to is Anita Hill.
And I think we're all, again, pretty familiar with who Anita Hill is. But just in case, when Clarence Thomas was nominated to be a Supreme Court justice, she came forward what's considered to be the first accusation of sexual harassment in the workplace.
Yeah, she was working as his like assistant in at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is ironic as fuck. So it was in the Department of Education, and it was at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and she was working under him, and other women were working under him as well. And so what's clear to remember is that in 1991, it's summer of 1991, September 6th, Anita Hill refuses to discuss the matter, right? And Democrats are in control of the Senate. You know, Biden is there. Democrats are in control of the Senate. And Biden is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. There are no men on this Judiciary Committee in the Senate in 1991. No men whatsoever. There's only two women in the whole Senate. So September 10th, the Thomas confirmation hearings begin. They last 10 days. They focus entirely only on Thomas's legal views. September 20th, they end. But these allegations are like in the air, I guess. And then finally, September 27th, Joe Biden says something a little weird. He says, quote, I believe there are certain things that are not at issue at all, and that is his character. This is about what he believes. I know my colleagues, and I urge everyone to refrain from personalizing this battle, which is weird. It is a weird thing to say. But then in October 6th, NPR lays out Hill's charges, including an interview with her. And then October 7th, Hill holds a press conference. And then October 8th, this is the final vote, and it's the schedule. It has been scheduled. But Republicans realize they don't have enough certain votes for his confirmation. And so Republican leader Bob Dole and the Democratic leader George Mitchell, they get together and they figure out, okay, what should we do? And so October 11th, finally, Biden opens Judiciary Committee hearings. Anita Hill testifies at these hearings. And this is where the story gets even worse.
Right. And this is, I think, where the story starts to feel, the whole story is eerily familiar.
Oh, yeah.
But I think this is where the story starts to veer into an almost exact copy of what's going on right now. What happens, Varsha?
So basically, Anita Hill, she makes a credible allegation. There are other women who refuse to come forward, like they're anonymous at the time, who also have similar allegations. And she begins, testifying. And people on the committee, specifically the men on the committee, even the Democrats on the committee, have horrible, horrible questions, right? So one example is Senator Heflin asks, are you a scorned woman? Do you have militant attitude relative to the area of civil rights? Senator Spector asks, you testified this morning that the most embarrassing question involved, and this is not too bad, women's large breasts, right? So Clarence Thomas is basically accused by Anita Hill of talking about sexually explicit things with her, like similar to Kaczynski, pornography, showing like sexually explicit images and videos to her, and asking her out repeatedly. And she spurns his advances and doesn't want to. And he's done this to other women, according to her and according to other women. And the hearings are just disgusting. Like, they don't actually let her make her case. First, Thomas testifies. Then Anita Hill testifies, and then Thomas testifies again. And so because Thomas is able to testify last, he's able to refute her point by point by point. There's no opportunity for her to rebut his rebuttals, right? And so she hasn't gotten a fair shake. But what's really gross is that the media narrative around her, especially in the conservative media and even in the mainstream media, is very much, why is she making these accusations now? What, why did she stay working at this job? Why didn't she quit this job? And it's very like, she's opportunistic.
Which is an interesting argument to make. And this is also where it starts to echo what's going on right now. Everyone's asking, including the fucking senators, Democratic senators, saying, this isn't so bad. This isn't bad. you know, he's just asking about your breasts. Like, who cares, right?
Yeah.
And then to come back and say, well, why didn't she leave? Why is she coming forward now? Obviously, people didn't think this was a big deal. And so you can't have it both ways. You can't say, oh, she should have left. She should have come forward earlier. And also say it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
They're completely contradictory statements. So, and that's exactly what's happening now. And we're going to get to Kavanaugh and the two accusations against him in just a minute. But I want to finish up with this Anita Hill part of it, because this ultimately was setting up this classic paradigm that we're still working within today when it comes to sexual harassment, especially in the workplace, or sexual harassment. And in terms of in Kavanaugh, a sexual assault of any type, is that it's not so bad and can be excused away. And also you didn't come forward soon enough.
Yeah.
And you're opportunistic.
Yeah.
And that was the narrative then. And that's the narrative now. And what makes the Anita Hill hearings so not just important, but I think we really have to realize and think through about these hearings is the fact that this started the beginning of this dichotomy that we're living in now.
Where this weird paradox where, like, it's not too bad, but also why did you continue to let it happen, right? Because that's the problem that certain men have understanding workplace sexual harassment, where they think, okay, if this is bad, why are you still working here? Because it's my fucking job. Like, what am I supposed to do? Just quit my job, right? I should be able to be safe in my workplace. And also,
and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about clerkships,
yeah,
and clerkships in general. Not only does your career depend on how you do in that clerkship, it depends on you getting it.
Yeah.
And so that's why I drew this line between Kennedy, Kaczynski, and Kavanaugh, is because who's getting these prestigious clerkships and what happens within those clerkships? And this is just a very specific example within the legal system and the legal community. But when you say, oh, you should have just left, but it's like, but leaving a job like that means ending your career.
Yeah. And I just want to point another way to draw this line is recently there was a story about Kavanaugh about how it wasn't a surprise that all of his clerks looked like models, right? And apparently Amy Chua, a Yale law professor, would say to her students, you should look good for your interviews in front of Kavanaugh. To her female students, you should look good in front of Kavanaugh. Look good. Not like have good credentials. And obviously they all do, but look good. Right. And this is, it's a clear, like, the way in which all aspects of this system, not just the judiciary and the clerkship system, but a lot of different jobs perpetuate a way for men to continue to harass women. It's pieces. It's not just that the man does it. It's like a lot of things have to happen to allow the man to continue to do it, to make it impossible for him to be fired. Or make it hard for him to be fired, or make it hard for him to make it hard for women who are accusing him, or people who are accusing him, men and women, to be believed, right? And another aspect of this paradox is how people are calling Christine Blasey Ford and any accuser who are accusing powerful men, right, of being like opportunistic, because Hill says something that's very similar to what Christine Blasey Ford said and what Ramirez said, which is a new allegation against Kavanaugh tonight. You know, Hill said, telling the world is the most difficult experience of my life, but it is very close to having lived through the experience that occasioned this meeting. She literally is comparing testifying in front of the Senate, telling the world her story, to the experience of sexual harassment. It's so hard for her to tell this story. And it's so embarrassing for her.
It's being harassed all over again,
yeah,
by a new set of men to question you and gaslight you.
Yeah. And the same thing is happening to Ford, where, like, this whole past week, male senators on the Judiciary Committee, the GOP Judiciary Committee, have been bullying her. And note, since 1991 to 2018, there have been no women on the GOP Judiciary Committee. In the history of the GOP's Judiciary Committee, there have been no women on the Judiciary Committee. And so anytime, like, a man is like, oh, does representation really matter? Fuck you, it does. There have been major changes because of the four women we have on the Judiciary Committee now, and because of the women we have in the Senate now, right? And so you mentioned at the beginning of the show how there are also, like, senators who are, like, implicated in this cycle, in this, like, I was talking to Devin before, it's like a swamp of, like, misogyny. It's everywhere. It leaks everywhere. So you know, not only is Biden asking stupid ass questions and being an asshole to Anita Hill, Storm Thurmond, Senator Storm Thurmond, is a segregationist, a racist, and he was accused of being a sexual harasser, a known sexual harasser, but nothing was, you know, he didn't have to resign in disgrace. He harassed not just reporters like Cokie Roberts from NPR. Senator Patty Murray would recall like how she would get in an elevator and he groped her breast, assuming that she was an intern. And Susan Collins, Senator Collins, would take the stairs to avoid getting in the elevator with Thurmond. That is a system of like, that is a hostile work environment, right? That is literally the description of a hostile work environment where a United States senator, maybe I disagree with her, but a United States senator isn't allowed to take the goddamn elevator because her colleague, another senator, is going to grope her.
Well, and then that really shines light on this, the bullshitness, the absolute fuckery of the question, why didn't you just leave?
Yeah.
Becoming a U.S. senator is not something you just do for fucking fun on a Sunday afternoon. These women worked hard. I mean, Susan Collins worked hard to get there. She ran a campaign. She spent a lot of money. She, you know, completely turned her life inside out. And she's just one example. Anita Hill, that job was important to her. And the fact that men are able to kind of erase that part of the narrative and just be like, well, if it was that bad, you would have fucking left. Like, no, that is not how this works.
Yep.
And also, to one last point, Varsha, you said it just goes on and on and on for so long. There's also, or it's so difficult to get men fired or to have men suffer any sort of consequence for their actions. Because I would like to point out that for Judge Kaczynski, Heidi Bond worked for him in 2006, and he didn't step down due to sexual harassment allegations until 2017.
Yep.
So, and that was just the first one that, you know, she was part of the ones who came out who we knew about. And so we knew it went back at least to 2006, and it was probably way before then. And so it's not just a system in which women are systematically denied access to these spaces. And then if they are there, basically subjected to torture for being there, but it's that it goes on and that it's an open secret and that it can take years to suss out. And even sometimes when you do suss it out, Clarence Thomas is still nominated and still is confirmed to be a Supreme Court justice where he sits today. And that is a powerful reminder that women telling their stories doesn't always mean that we've broken the cycle, but it does get us closer to doing so.
Yeah. And it's also really difficult because of the way that we're told to tell our stories, right? So another thing that was happening over this weekend was the hashtag why I didn't report, because our esteemed asshole president was like, why didn't you tell the FBI 30 years ago, Christine Blasey Ford, right? And everyone was like, for a lot of reasons, because one, when you experience sexual assault, you are usually embarrassed. It's really hard for you to deal with the fact that this is something that you experienced, and it's really hard to deal with that trauma. It's really hard to deal with a lot of things. The way that Anita Hill was forced to tell her story, it didn't allow her to seem like a credible witness or a credible victim or a credible survivor at all.
They forced her into a situation.
Yeah, they forced her into a situation, and they talked about her to her face in a way that was very condescending and derogatory. And it wasn't just the Republicans, it was everyone on that committee, right? And it was also in the media, where like there's this quote that I just cannot believe is a real quote, but I should believe it. David Brock called her a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. And they would accuse her of just trying to be like a homewrecker, basically, or she's just trying to like ruin his life. And Clarence Thomas himself would be like, this is a high-tech lynching, which I understand, like, I am not an African-American person, but using that kind of language to describe what's happening to you when you clearly are guilty of sexual harassment is so fucked up. It belittles the history of actual lynchings, right? And the same thing happens when men are accused. They call it a witch hunt, they call it a lynching. And it's so disgusting that for some reason, from 1991 to 2018, for the history before that, we always empathize with the men and we do not empathize with the women who are accusing them, with the women who have suffered this trauma. And that's what Anita Hill's story is about. It's about how throughout the testimony, throughout the whole story, nobody empathized with her. No one no one in power empathized with her and nobody believed her. I'm saying nobody in power on the Senate Judiciary Committee in the Senate believed her enough to say, no, fuck you, Clarence Thomas. We're not going to vote for you.
Okay, Varsha, so now that we have sort of talked about context, limited context, there's obviously so much more to the story that we do not even have access to. But I want to talk specifically about the two women who have accused Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault. So can you tell us once again about Christine Blasey Ford's and the allegations and then the new allegations from Ramirez, who was a freshman at Yale with Brett Kavanaugh.
So Christine Blasey Ford is now a psychologist in California. And in this summer, early this summer, she sends a letter with her allegations to Representative Anna Ishu, who's her House representative, and then Senator Dianne Feinstein. And she requested an anonymity, right? And then she finally came forward in on Sunday, September 16th, because The Intercept and BuzzFeed basically figured out it was her. I think BuzzFeed figured out it was her. The Intercept just initially reported on the letter that Feinstein had referred to the FBI. And what Ford alleges is that in the early 80s, when they were at a party in high school, Kavanaugh pinned her down on a bed, attempted to remove her clothing, covered her mouth when she tried to scream. And then there was also Mark Judge, who was watching and at times telling Kavanaugh to stop, at times telling, like, egging Kavanaugh on. And then this whole thing stopped when, like, a judge jumped on the bed and Ford was able to literally escape and run and lock herself into the bathroom and leave the house finally, right? And the reason that this allegation is credible, in my opinion, and probably in the opinion of a lot of people, is that when she sent in this letter before Kavanaugh was officially nominated, only when she found out that he was on the shortlist. And then she asked for anonymity for the longest time, but she did tell her husband, and she told her therapy, she told her therapist when they were in couples therapy in 2012, before Kavanaugh even, like, existed on the national sphere. Like, he was a judge, but he wasn't going to be, like, the Supreme Court nominee in 2012, right? And she also took a polygraph test, which, you know, you can say aren't 100% accurate, but they're still accurate enough to talk about as, like, this is how much she believes in her own accusations. And even though it's not legally admissible, it is still admissible in the way that you're talking about the credibility of her allegations.
Right. And so what I want to say, too, is this: the existence of this letter was reported on, like you said, by BuzzFeed and The Intercept on September 16th.
Yeah, we found out it was Ford on September 16th. But the day before, when we didn't find out it was Ford, right, like, literally, it was a Friday. It was a Friday where this Intercept story came out, or this accusation story came out, and then more came out about the accusation. And then when more came out of the accusation, within 24 hours, I think on Saturday or something, the Judiciary Committee, the GOP side, came out with a letter of 65 women who knew Kavanaugh in high school who said, oh yeah, Kavanaugh's a great guy.
So, right, it was within 24 hours of that, they had a signed letter by 65 women saying Kavanaugh's a great guy. Here's the issue with that. There is no way that they put that together in 24 hours, mm-hmm. because they already fucking knew. They knew this about Kavanaugh going into this. They had that letter ready to go for when, not even necessarily if, these allegations came out. And my question has always been, well, maybe they didn't. Did they know about Ford specifically, or did they know about allegations in general, or did they know about another set of allegations and that this just happened to come out and they already had this letter ready to go?
Yeah. I just want to quickly point out, before the nominations were announced, before Kavanaugh's nomination was announced in the summer, it was reported that McConnell did not want Kavanaugh because of his long paper trail. But it was also, like, reported that, like, these judges were being heavily, these nominees, these potential nominees were being heavily vetted by the Federalist Society. And a story came out this week about how Kavanaugh was extremely frustrated during his vetting process because people were asking him personal-ass questions. And I wonder why. I wonder why he, right. He was frustrated when people asked him questions about his drinking or his private life. Maybe because he has some shit in his closet that he's hiding.
So, yeah. So it was always my thought that there's no way that there was only one instance of this. There was only going to be one story or one woman coming forward. I always knew there had to be more because men like this don't do this once. And So I think that's kind of where we get to the next part of the story, which is Ramirez. So Denise Ramirez came forward. What is her allegation, Varsha?
Deborah Ramirez comes forward, right? And so she is, she's a freshman with Kavanaugh at Yale when they're both at Yale. She's at this dorm party. Everyone is drinking. And she describes the story as, you know, we were sitting in a circle. People would pick who drank. Ramirez is chosen repeatedly to drink. So she is drunk. She admits that she's drunk. And she waited to tell the story because she wanted to like actually remember everything that happened before she comes out, because she doesn't want to seem uncredible, which she doesn't want to seem that she's lying, right? Which is so, so depressing, because clearly she knows this has happened, but because she was drinking too, she waits to tell her story. And she says, I remember a penis being in front of my face. I knew that's not what I wanted, even in that state of mind. And then, you know, she pushed the person away. And then she remembers that it was Kavanaugh standing in front of her and laughing. And she says, Brett was laughing. I can still see his face and his hips coming forward, like when you pull up your pants. And then she remembers clearly that somebody yelled down the law. Somebody yelled down the hall, Brett Kavanaugh just put his penis in Debbie's face. It was his full name, she remembers. She remembers it wasn't just Brett, it was Brett Kavanaugh, right? And this whole story, this whole New Yorker story, which is reported by Jane Meyer and Ronan Farrow, it tells a larger story about the culture at Yale that Kavanaugh was involved in, which was just involved a lot of drinking, a lot of partying. And it also tells the culture of Georgetown Prep, the high school that Kavanaugh went to, which also involved a lot of drinking and partying. But basically, this accusation is, I also think, pretty credible, because there are women that Ramirez told, there are people that Ramirez told, there are people cited in the story who say they believe Ramirez. And there's also people who recollect, you know, the way Kavanaugh acted when he got drunk. Somebody says that, you know, Kavanaugh was relatively shy until he drank, at which point this person says Kavanaugh could become aggressive and even belligerent. And so this story is horrific. And there are people out there who'd be like, oh, maybe it wasn't that bad. They were just partying. It's still horrific because it shows a pattern. And there was also like a throwaway story within this story, which is really goes against the credibility of Mark Judge, the person who witnessed that first assault with, you know, with Christine Blasey Ford, where this woman recalls that Judge told her about other boys taking turns having sex with a drunk woman. And this was at Georgetown Prep, right? And so this whole story, this whole New Yorker story, which was really difficult to read through because it was so like, it was so triggering and gross at every paragraph. It just shows the culture that Kavanaugh has been involved in since high school and how he acted in that culture. And it just makes clear that Kavanaugh is not fit to be a Supreme Court justice, let alone a judge on the D.C. circuit.
Let alone a human being who's allowed to walk around the streets of Washington, D.C. like a fucking human. He's not really qualified for that either. So much of this entire story about Kavanaugh has been swathed in credibility. And it's all about who's credible and why. Is Christine Blasey Ford credible? Now is Ramirez credible? Why did they come forward? Why did they wait? Did this really happen? Who can say? Like, it's been so much about believing these women. And I think because of the Me Too movement, there is this push to believe women and to believe the stories that they're bringing forward. And so that's been so much of it. And so a lot of what has felt revolutionary about this moment is that, again, like with the Anita Hill story, it's now the story has become less about, are these women credible? Because I don't think anyone really didn't believe Anita Hill. But they tried to cast her as a homewrecker or trying to ruin Clarence Thomas's life. But from what I can tell, ultimately the narrative was about, well, it wasn't that bad, and that you're blowing this out of proportion and it doesn't mean anything, and you're just a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty, to quote David Brock. And it wasn't necessarily about being credible or not. And I would argue that we're in the same space right now. I think that there is definitely, you know, people are obviously saying, oh, there's no way that happened. Kavanaugh is obviously flatly denying all of these allegations, and people are getting into all of these granular debates about when and where and how and friends of friends and who. And obviously that's all, always going to be part of it, is believing these women.
Yeah. I just want to point out like the bullshit that Kavanaugh came out with earlier today about how earlier Sunday about how he's like, he's definitely right. He comes out with like calendars from the summer of 1982 that he plans to hand to the Judiciary Committee that show that there wasn't a party on that day. And I'm just like, how the fuck do you know if you wrote down the day of an illicit party where you were going to attempt to rape someone? What the fuck? No, that's, right? That's not a thing. And also, like, he literally said, like, obviously this doesn't disprove allegations by Dr. Blasey. That's what the you know, the report says. But apparently Kavanaugh wants to argue that, you know, this proves there's no corroboration for her account. Yeah, because maybe you didn't write it in your calendar, but maybe it's in, like, you know, it's in her fucking therapist notes that this fucking happened. So what the fuck? Like, maybe you just didn't write it in your calendar. Hey, I think I'm going to attempt to rape someone today.
Well, also, just so we're clear, like, having a paper calendar from 1982 just laying around, like, that's totally fucking normal.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
How, like, does he, like,
no one buys this.
So Judge Kavanaugh has kept a calendar every day of his life for days he hasn't done bad stuff, right? He has a calendar every day of his life proving he's never done bad stuff on day X in 2000 or 2003 when he was, when he probably got an email about torture. He doesn't, like, you know, he has a day saying, oh, I didn't get that email about torture. Oh, when I was clerking for Kaczynski, my calendar says I didn't get an email about, like, you know, about women and having sex with women. For my judge, right? Like, what the fuck?
This is basically setting up the narrative that this man's word, mm-hmm. even if it's a decades old calendar, is somehow more worthy than the live breathing women telling their story in front of them.
This is what rape culture is. This is what rape culture is finding any way to discredit a woman, right? Either it's you're ruining this man's future in the case of like Brock Turner or literally Brett Kavanaugh or Clarence Thomas, or it's you're not credible because I have some random ass proof, or it's you're blowing this out of proportion.
Right. And I think that that's where I think where we are right now in this moment, in this particular case. Because with these accusations against Brett Kavanaugh, it started as like a wholesale denial, mm-hmm. right? This never happened. This person isn't credible. There's no way. And we've shifted, though. And Kavanaugh has not, for obvious reasons. But the sort of conversation around this, too, we're at an interesting point where now Republicans are defending a 17-year-old's right to try to rape another 17-year-old. There was a piece written in the National Review, which I will not link to because it is disgusting. And I apologize that I even have to talk about this piece in any way, shape, or form. But I think it's important, and I think it really shows where we are in terms of rape culture. So this was published in the National Review by noted dickwad Dennis Prager, which, don't Google him. It's not worth it. He's fucking awful. The title of the piece is "The Charges Against Judge Kavanaugh Should Be Ignored." The central thesis of this piece is not this woman is not credible and these things never happened. The central argument is it doesn't matter. That what you did as a 17-year-old shouldn't matter. And that there are so many instances of sexual harassment and sexual assault that if we took all of them seriously, you know, there would be no more men left in society. There are a couple of quotes in particular that really drove this home. The first one is, quote, "Those who claim the charges against Judge Kavanaugh by Christine Blasey Ford are important and worth investigating, and that they ultimately, if believed, invalidate this candidacy for the U.S. Supreme Court are stating that A, what a middle-aged adult did in high school is all we need to know to evaluate an individual's character, even when his entire life has been impeccable. And B, no matter how good and moral a life one has led for 10, 20, 30, 40, or 50 years, it is nullified by a sin committed as a teenager."
Wow. I guess Dennis Prager is now really all for, like, criminal justice reform, right? Because I just want to say, like, I hate this argument. I really fucking hate this argument because these people are not people who are saying, oh, yeah, Donald Trump was wrong for saying that Central Park 5 should get the death penalty for a crime they didn't fucking commit, or that, you know, Tamir Rice was an adult. Like, what the fuck, right? And I'm not arguing that, like, if Judge Kavanaugh, like, let's say he did this, right? If he did this, the way that I would give him forgiveness, or the way that somebody should give him forgiveness, is if he had come forward, went to jail for what he did at 17, or went to jail at 18, or whatever, got his life together, somehow became a lawyer, and then he had never done anything ever again. Sure. Because that's someone who atones for their sins, atones for something they've done wrong, right? Like, pays for their mistakes. Like, I'm not saying every single person should pay for their mistakes forever, because obviously I believe in, you know, reformed convicts being able to vote, right? Obviously, you know, Judge Kavanaugh should be given what Republicans like to call due process. But that due process was never given to him because he has not admitted, he has not been contrite. He has not asked for forgiveness. He is denying this and calling all of these women liars. He's literally saying Christine Blasey Ford, Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, Deborah Ramirez, all these people are liars. That's not somebody who's asking for forgiveness. That's someone who's lying.
And if you want to make that argument, then the single sin committed as a teenager has continued. It's not just the one sin,
yeah.
Right? It's, you know, it's not coming forward. It's not taking responsibility. It's calling everyone liars. But even more than that, our justice system has a piece of this baked in, saying if you've led an exemplary life for X number of years, in the form of statute of limitations.
Yeah.
Brett Kavanaugh can no longer be charged with this crime. And I don't necessarily agree with it, but I think that's part of the due process that's trying to correct for this idea that something you did so long ago, you know, depending on the severity, doesn't need to be charged 40, 50 years later. Again, I'm not saying I agree with that, but I'm saying that's already baked into the system.
Yeah.
So this idea that it actually doesn't matter. And this is the newest. This is, I think, more where we are here,
yeah,
where it's not so much about whether or not it happened. Now people want to know whether or not it matters.
Yeah.
Because they think that, oh, it's this boys will be boys mentality. It's this idea that what he did at 17, even if it was holding a girl, a 15-year-old girl down and choking her and trying to rip her clothing off, well, it was so long ago. And does it even really matter? Isn't she just blowing it out of proportion?
Yeah.
Those are the questions that are being asked right now. And that is where the right is defending Brett Kavanaugh here. We're not even necessarily talking about credibility anymore. I mean, in this same article, he goes on to say, quote, this is a direct quote, "Nearly every woman past puberty has experienced a man trying to grope her. This is, needless to say, wrong." And then he goes on, he tells the story. "When my wife was a waitress in her mid-teens, the manager of her restaurant grabbed her breasts and squeezed them on numerous occasions. She told him to buzz off, figured out how to avoid being in places where they were alone, and continued going about her job. That's empowerment."
Fuck you. Oh my God. I'm just reading this right now because I was reading it and I was like, I'm reading it while you're saying it. I'm like, oh my God. First of all, like, I feel really bad for his wife. I'm sorry she had to deal with that. But second,
yeah,
not everyone has the ability to tell their manager to buzz off and then figure out how to avoid being in places where they're working, right? So, like, for example, if, like, some asshole where I work, like, harassed me, in every place I've worked in an open floor plan with not a lot of people, and I can't just avoid people, right? If it's, like, God forbid, somebody in my department or someone in the previous place where I worked, if they were sexually harassing me, I couldn't just avoid them. It's not always possible. Also, the notion that that's empowerment, where she just has to avoid doing her job in certain places, she has to continue working in fear of this could happen. That's empowerment? No. What empowerment is getting this guy fucking fired. That's what empowerment is.
Well, and I just want to finish with this little piece de resistance, because this was published last week. This was his closing argument. Quote, "In sum, I am not interested in whether Mrs. Ford, which, by the way, she's a doctor and a professor, so fuck you, an anti-Trump activist, which she's not, is telling the truth. Because even if true, what happened to her was clearly wrong. But it tells us nothing about Brett Kavanaugh since the age of 17. But for the record, I don't believe her story. Aside from too many missing details, most women remember virtually everything about the circumstances of a sexual assault, no matter how long
That's
ago.
That's not true.
Few men, yeah, I know. Few men do what she charges Kavanaugh with, having done only one time. And no other woman has ever charged him with any sexual misconduct.
Boom.
So he kind of, yeah, I know. So he kind of hedges his bets there a little bit and says, well, I don't believe her, but let's just say for the sake of, you know, sake of argument that she is telling the truth, it doesn't matter. And that honestly, you know, it's, she's not telling the truth because no one's ever done this once and no one else has come forward.
Can I tell you a sad story?
Yes.
Last week, a regular white dude was telling me the same exact thing about how he wants to believe Ford, but he doesn't really believe her because other stories would have come out already. And he's like, I don't know if I can believe her because this is the only story. And then, you know, today he's like, oh shit. Literally, he messaged me, he's like, oh shit.
Yeah.
And so this is what I'm talking about. And so another reason that Kavanaugh's quote unquote sin from 17 matters, same thing with like what he did in 18. So people might be saying, oh, what he did to Deborah Ramirez doesn't matter because he was 18. Who cares what people do in college? Boys will be boys. But remember Senator Mazie Hirono. So this is a quote from the New Yorker story. By his freshman year, Kavanaugh was 18 and legally an adult. During his confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Kavanaugh swore under oath that as a legal adult, he had never committed any verbal or physical harassment or assault of a sexual nature. Thank you, Senator Hirono, because you caught fucking Brett Kavanaugh in a fucking lie. He lied. He fucking lied.
And so ultimately, I think the reason why I want to go through this story in such detail is not just because obviously it's so awful, but because we are repeating the same mistakes. We're not necessarily repeating them. We're just making the same one over and over. It's the same mistake that's been happening since Anita Hill. It's the same mistake that's been happening since 1975 when Alex Kaczynski started clerking for Anthony Kennedy. And the fact of the matter is that women have been excluded, and they've been excluded so vehemently that even when they do get the slightest opportunity to be in one of these male-dominated spaces, they are taken out violently. It's not just, it's violence. And men and even boys, even 17 and 18-year-old boys, are using this violence to keep women out of their spaces. Yale's very prestigious. And you talked about this culture of drinking and partying that was at Yale and Georgetown. It's because those Yale and Georgetown for so long were these male-dominated spaces where privilege ran rampant and where there were no consequences for actions. And when women start to infiltrate that, when women start to become part of these systems, the only response, even subconsciously, that these boys and men, 18-year-old men, knew is to weaponize women's bodies and to get them out as horrifically as possible so they don't come back. And, you know, there was a really, really great tweet by at Wagatwe, and she said, quote, I hope y'all see why Betsy DeVos's new Title IX guidelines are so dangerous. She will allow more Brett Kavanaughs to be bred on our campuses, using victims' bodies as collateral damage in their pursuit of power. And I think that ultimately this story is both so specific and so universal. It's about these women and their trauma in particular. And it's also about Anita Hill. And it's also about powerful men. And it's about the way we treat women and exclude them from annals of power in this country. That starts early, which is why things like, you know, making it easier for sexual harassment to breed on college campuses is only going to lead to more of this. Because at the beginning of this show, I started by drawing the line from Anthony Kennedy to Kaczynski to Kavanaugh. Three men since 1975. There's a direct line in that many years to two potential Supreme Court nominees. Supreme Court seats are so rare, and so there's only been 113 in the history of the world. And two of them are connected. It really makes you realize that these stories are about rape and trauma, and they're also about violence and power and men's privilege, but it's about keeping women out, and they're succeeding. And I think that we need to look at this holistically, and Kavanaugh needs to get the fuck out, And we need to start reanalyzing the way women's bodies have been used to perpetuate their own oppression.
Yeah. I mean, I want to bring in a historical analogy, and it's not an analogy. It's more like I want to look at how historians have analyzed another issue dealing with women's bodies and how it like relates to this one. And it's weird, but basically like when South Asian historians are taught about the history of the British Empire and the way they reform India and India's legal system during the empire in the 19th century, they're taught about how it's done on the backs of women. And it's done on the backs of women's bodies, because the first thing that's reformed is the abolishment of sati, which is widow immolation. And then it's the age of consent, and then it's widow remarriage. But throughout this process, what's entrenched is not just the reform of like what the British people see as good reform that's helping Indian women. It's also the entrenchment of the Hindu patriarchy, the Indian patriarchy, and how they feel that women should be treated. And that kind of patriarchy perpetuated by the British and men in India is something that lives on to the 20th century, lives on after India's independence, and lives on to today. And it's that kind of system, the way that like we allow that system to be created in attempts at quote unquote reform or attempts at quote unquote equality, it still perpetuates that. And so when you hire 50% female clerks, that's awesome. When you hire 50% women in your workplace, that's great. But you have to take the extra step of actually making sure that women and men are safe in your workplace, are safe in your society. And that's something that we're not doing. Not only are we not doing it, we're not even acknowledging that it is a problem. You know, we're saying it's overblown, right? And so the way that laws and ideology is built on women's bodies is something, it's a tale as old as time. Right. It's not just something that's happened in America in the past 200 or so years. It's something that's happened before that as well. And this is not something new, but the way that we have to deal with it has to rupture the way we've been dealing with it, because 1991 to 2018 is too long for us to not have learned anything.
Well, Farsha, that is it for us. I this was a different episode, but I'm really glad that we tackled it in this way.
Yeah, me too. It was really difficult listening and reading about all of this stuff this past week, and I'm really glad I got to talk it through. It was a lot.
Yeah, tackle it a little differently. I think it goes without saying that an action item for this week is to call your senators about Kavanaugh. And I'm going to add on to that. Start asking the men in your life to denounce this boys will be boys culture. I know it seems an odd request, right? But the more men that we can get to say that the devaluation of women's bodies is unacceptable, you know, it's going to be good. There are obviously so many other things you can take, like donate to survivors' funds, reach out to people, you know, believe these women, believe women who come forward. But I also think an odd one that I've seen is you know, talk to the men in your life and get them on board here too, because we need to start teaching our men and our boys that this is unacceptable.
Yeah.
But I hope, thank you so much for listening, and I hope that this was a conversation that was at least cathartic. It was cathartic for me.
Yeah, me too.
All right, Hellions, we will be back here on Thursday with a very special guest. We also have an episode of Crush the Midterms and Candidate coming out on Tuesday, so stay tuned for that. Have a great week, raise some hell, and remember to practice some compassion. Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere. Hellbent Media has 2 new shows, Crush the Midterms in partnership with Purpose and Crush the Midterms, about how to get involved in campaigns in the run-up to the 2018 midterm elections, and Candidate, Real Conversations with Women Running for Office in partnership with Emily's List. Each week, we speak to a couple of female candidates running for office, all centered around a theme. So check both of those out, listen, subscribe, and rate those in iTunes as well.